You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi there, it's everyone's favorite name brand allergy medicine, Drew Gasparini here with another episode of Now We're Talking, the podcast that won't shut up during your kid's recital. Fuck your kid. Today, our guest is someone I go back a long time with. He's a kind soul who always has me laughing when I see him. You know him for his work on stage in shows like Triassic Park, Lysistrata Jones, Wicked, and the Deaf West production of Spring Awakening. Hell, you might know him for his work on screen in shows like The Bold and the Beautiful, or the Emmy Award-nominated series that he co-created, The Indoor Boys. He's an actor, a writer, a Tony-nominated producer, and a good friend of mine. I'm thrilled he's here. Everyone, now we're talking with Alex Wise.
I would like to start by saying, I feel like you're just one of those, you're one of those rare people that kind of no matter what the circumstance or the situation, but when I see you, I'm always kind of uplifted and have a marvelous time.
That's so kind, because there's so many casting directors who have disagreed, and it's just... so nice to hear some positive feedback and from someone in the industry. It's
in
really
the industry.
Great.
And listen, I'm on the other side of the table. You're sure. Always welcome. Come on in anytime. I think everybody should start referring to you as the Jewish space laser of musical theater.
You know, I do feel like I am a hot button congressional issue. And I do feel like I have a laser focus and a Jewish look.
Alex, how you been, man? I haven't like talked to you in well over a year, it seems. Oh no, when did I last see you? Yeah, about a year ago, over a year
ago. Was
it? Yeah, you sang at the I Could Use a Drink re-release concert at 54 Below, and I think that's the last time I saw you.
That was one of the most amazing nights.
Oh, thanks. I had fun. I'm just happy that you were able to do it. That's my joy, is just getting to hang and watch you do your thing.
And like able to do it, you mean like you could still hit the notes vaguely.
But boy, could you. Like, holy well. Shit. I think you got one of those voices, man. You have that. You have like, I don't know. It's a powerhouse. People can hear you in the rafters. You just got this like voice that carries and carries and carries. Alex, so this podcast really is about a whole lot of nothing. I mean, like it really is. It was kind of my 2020 excuse to make time with my showbiz friends. And what better way to do that than start a podcast, I feel like. And I consider you one of my showbiz friends. And we've sat and we've had meals together and we've done collaborative things together. But there's a whole lot I don't know about you. And I'd like to start with like all of that.
I was born on a misty Tuesday.
It was misty. I saw that in Wikipedia. It was a misty Tuesday, which is such a great porn star name. Misty Tuesday.
Oh, that really is. That's really nice. Wow. Or good drag name, you know.
Great drag name, absolutely.
Welcome Misty to the Tuesday. Stage, Misty Tuesday. Wearing train conductor couture. what was I like? Well, first off, I'm really excited you started a podcast because you have a really good announcer voice.
No.
Yeah. So I think it's a really good move for you. It's a lateral move. I'm not going to lie. It's a lateral move. But I think it's a really good move.
You're kidding me. It's that forward resonance. I place everything right up here in the mask, baby. That's where it lives. Yeah. Now we're talking. Yeah,
that's absolutely working. Okay. All right. Well, this is the part right now I have to start talking about myself.
No, you have to start talking.
No, I don't want to. This is where I start sweating. And I'm like, no, anything but me. Let me stall more with more jokes. Okay. Let's see. Okay. So I was born in Cleveland, Ohio, which was very lovely and suburban and fine.
That's when you drive into Cleveland, that's the big sign. It's fine.
It's fine.
It's Cleveland. Fine.
That's fine. You know, it's funny, yeah, looking back on it, I'm so thankful that I'm from Cleveland because I think it's such a great town that's full of so much theater and art and culture, and it was very liberal. I mean, compared to so many other places in the world. When I was a kid, though, I didn't have the perspective, and the only thing that I wanted was to go to New York City. You know, but looking back, I can be really appreciative of all that I had in Cleveland and all the opportunities that were afforded to me.
Like, what was it about New York City, though? Because I'm also, you know, I might be from the Bay Area, but a suburb for sure, and my idea of New York City was so romanticized. That's a word? That's
yeah,
a word.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah.
By like Seinfeld or Friends. I was like, I am either going to be one of these coffee drinking yuppies or one of these really complainy New Yorkers, and I'm happy with either. And that was kind of my perception of New York. What made you be like, ah, New York's got to be the place? Was it strictly theater that made you see the appeal of this big, bright, buzzy city?
Yeah, I mean, it was, well, first off, I'd like to say that between complainer and yuppie coffee drink, you're kind of both. Like, you really won both of those quite well, right?
This is all by design. It's all by design, exactly.
Yeah, and for me, New York was just all theater and Broadway, and that was just magic to me when I was a kid.
So theater was like, you were super young when you started loving it.
Yeah, I mean, I saw my first Broadway show when I was a little kid. And I had a grandmother who lived in New York, who was the coolest person in the whole wide world. She lived in New York City on 71st and Fifth Avenue. And she was like a chic fur hat wearing, like fierce, screaming at cab drivers. And she was just,
I love this woman.
Yeah, like a real, like you'd find her in the libretto of Company. You know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, she was really that kind of, you know, she probably like, you know, I think she even might have like known Elaine Stritch just casually.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
No big deal. She casually knew Elaine.
Right, yeah. She actually was friends. So my grandmother was a writer.
Okay.
And she would, yeah, and she worked a little bit in theater. She did a lot in advertising. She wrote a lot of like slogans for advertising that are still used today. And she was just like, she wrote like, my grandma wrote, with a name like Smuckers, it has to be good.
No.
And she made up the name Bed Bath and Beyond.
No,
and
she did not.
Yeah, she did.
Oh my God, that sounds like completely made up factual stuff, but this is real, real factual stuff.
That's real. That's my grandmother, Lois Wise.
Lois Wise. God, I was going to ask for the name. Yeah, Lois. Yeah. All right. We love her.
Yeah, she was so cool, but she was such a, she was so steeped in culture and she loved theater and you know, my parents really loved theater too. So they were always taking me to the touring shows that would come, downtown to the touring houses in Cleveland. And then once a year we'd go to New York and my grandma would take me to a bunch of shows.
Yeah.
So as a little kid, I was seeing Secret Garden when I was like little. And
what a good one to see at such a young age.
And you know, the stuff for kids, like I saw Beauty and the Beast and I saw Phantom and so I was just totally obsessed with it and thought it was the most magical thing in the world. And so for me, New York was always the goal. And my grandmother always said to me, she was quite a wordsmith, evidently, you know, and she would always say to me, she said, Alex, Cleveland is a from place and New York is a to place.
I love this woman so much.
She was
everything
brilliant.
Everything you have said of this woman, I am completely obsessed with.
Yes, no, she was
it's a from truly, place. God bless her.
Yeah, she was amazing. She was amazing. I mean, she wrote like 60 books, you know. She was she was really cool.
This is your dad's mom.
That's right. It was my dad's mom. Yeah.
Amazing.
She died when I was in college, but I had a great relationship with her all through my childhood and teenage years and the beginning of my adulthood. And she really showed me what New York was. And she was the one who helped amplify that dream for me. And and then my parents are really awesome, too, because they were so generous about allowing me to audition for shows and being the ones who would drive me to rehearsals and letting me do, I mean, granted, you know, they're Jewish, so they were deeply afraid for me at all times.
Of course.
You know,
deeply afraid. I love that.
Yeah, you know, as only Jewish parents could be, you know.
Sure, sure. I understand.
You know, there was love and support and just deep fear.
But
and
coded so, in, yeah, immense violent fear for their child, sure.
Yeah, yeah, violent love and violent fear. So, so yeah, New York was always the dream. And I actually, you know, never, a lot of my career has also been in like television. And I never thought that TV was an option for me because I, that's a different conversation.
You remind me, no, it's all part of the same conversation because I actually have this written down. There is something about you and the way you have navigated your journey through theater and then transitioned into the screen and TV kind of world and producing world and writing world. You're like a Ron Howard of our generation, just in terms of how you managed to have a finger in one of these pies within show business at all times. And it doesn't look like your relevancy will ever, ever falter. You're always going to have something going on in a way that attracts a good number of people at all times. You have something so fucking likable about you. It's the Ron Howard complex. I really think that. When you, you know, when I first visited New York, I was like 19 or 20. And the first show I saw was the last, maybe it had 2 weeks left of its run, was Beauty and the Beast. And I saw it when I was a kid. These actors were so tired. They were so, they were so done. This is a very true story. It was a matinee. I was bewildered at how small the theaters were because, you know, touring houses in some of the world, in some of the country are like gigantic. So when you're used to like seeing something in a touring production, you're used to this like 3,000 seat theater some of the time. And Broadway, a lot of people don't realize if they haven't been, these theaters are a little more intimate, it feels like. You're a little squished in. Very New York. You're very elbow to elbow with people. So it was a slightly more uncomfortable than I wanted it to be. And then the Maurice, whoever was playing Maurice in this production.
Crazy old Maurice.
Crazy old Maurice goes, there was a beast. Oh, that's not the line. He said that. He said that. He fucking upped his line and then out loud said, wait, that's not the line.
Oh my God. That's so disappointing.
And that's when I was like, if it's this easy, I'm just going to go into writing Broadway shows.
Wait, I have to tell a quick story that piggybacks off the story you just told.
Yes,
when
please.
I was very obsessed with flop musicals all through my childhood because I'm really very dorky. I love theater history and I want to know all about Gantry, which ran for one performance and so on. You know what I mean? So I convinced my parents when I was a kid, they were like, we're going to New York. What do you want to see? I was like, okay, well, obviously we're going to see, you know, The Crucible with Liam Neeson and Laura Linney. And obviously we're going to see, and, you know, a few other options that I had. And then I said, but we're going to see Dance of the Vampires. And they're like, oh, what's Dance of the Vampires? And I was like, it is the show that will define the rest of my life. I mean, how, you know, telling that was. But I was so... so dead set on seeing this, and my parents trust me. They're like, okay, great. So they took me to see Dance of the Vampires. Cut to the end of the story real quick. They were furious with me. But while we were watching the show, which I was loving every single second of, I remember there was a part where the vampires were dancing in the aisles, the ensemble of vampires. Oh, and there was one girl in the ensemble who probably knew the woman she was sitting in the audience whom she was dancing in front of. And I was sitting right by and she leaned over to some girl who was sitting right by me. And she goes, I'm so tired. And I remember. So it's interesting about this story for me is I remember. And that moment I was like, oh my God, they're people. There are people who are like doing a job. Like this was the opposite for me of what it was for you. It was a completely magical moment where I got to see behind the curtain.
Yeah.
And I was like, wait, there are people and I'm people and I could be tired one day too. You know?
Oh my God. The dream was always to become tired. That's always been the dream.
And boy, did I achieve it because I am exhausted.
Oh my God. I love that. That woman, I'm so tired. I am obsessed with that story.
And it was totally magical. It was so magical. I was in heaven when that happened.
Oh my God.
And I couldn't believe it. You know, it was a good thing that experience was mixed in also with like one of the best things I ever saw, which was The Crucible with Liam Neeson and Laura Linney, which was like the best acting I'd ever seen. Okay.
Oh my God.
going back to your question, though, my dad always he works and worked in advertising because it was the family business, and he was working there for a long time, and he was in charge of a lot of commercials and stuff, and he would deal with children. There's a point to this, and he would deal with like kids. Yeah, he would deal with kids on the commercials, and I think seeing that he was pretty dead set on me not moving to New York and being a child actor.
What did he see in specific, though? I mean, like, honest to God, how bad? This isn't Ohio.
No, because he was also working in New York a little bit, and you know, his parents' advertising business was located in Cleveland and New York, and so there was a lot of stuff like that happening. But my parents were pretty sure that they did not want me to go be a child actor on the Broadway, though I begged them. I was just begging. It's all I wanted. It was the dream.
Yeah.
And you know, looking back, I'm of two minds about it. One is, what a missed opportunity. I have the prettiest little soprano voice of all time. And I totally could have booked Beauty and the Beast.
Of course.
Yeah. And the second thing is, I'm thankful that I didn't do that, because I got to be ruined as an adult instead of as a child.
True that. And you are definitely ruined now. I could see you starting like to smoke cigarettes by the time you're 11 if you went into child acting.
I would have.
Not because it was the cool thing to do, but because you're so exhausted.
I would have been exhausted. And I would have been between shows, you know. I would have been at the time ordering in Kodama, you know, rest in peace, Kodama. And I just would have needed my cigarette break on the balcony with the musicians.
The image of this is so great. Bitching about union stuff with the musicians. Yeah, I love
course.
It.
Of course. I'm like, 802 lets you do what? Okay. But
that is amazing. Holy crap.
So that being said, I was never a child actor in New York, but I was doing a lot of shows as a kid. So there's like a lot of local professional theater, not quite big regional theaters, but
you played Oliver at one point, I'm guessing.
Yes, I was in Oliver 4 times as a child.
Of course, absolutely.
And in fact, I got cast a fifth time, and my mother said no. She was like, "You cannot do this again."
She turned it down for you.
Yeah, she said, "You can't do it." I was like, "Mother, they're offering me Oliver." She said, "You played it. You played it, and you'd have to miss some school." I was like, "It's just a week." But
oh my gosh,
always a battle. But I did a ton of theater as a kid. I did a lot of. And with a lot of people who ended up going to New York and who are a part of the business now, like one of your close friends, Andrew Kober, he was Mr. Bumble to my Oliver. Do you know that?
I swear to God, I had no idea about that. And I love that so much. He is still Mr. Bumble. That's such a Bumble. He is such a Bumble. Oh my God.
And you know what? I'm such, you know, despite my wry nature, I'm such an Oliver. I mean, I look so hungry. So it all works.
You know what I love about like community theater with kids is exactly that. When you see like a 14-year-old girl playing Widow Peru or something like that. And I remember playing, I was double cast with Matt Doyle as Billy Bigelow. And they didn't water down the script of Carousel at all. And there's a line, because he's a horrible guy. He's just a horrible man. He says, "Shut your mouth or I'll slap you upside the jaw." I was 14 saying this to like a 12-year-old girl. How insane is that shit?
Oh God. I bet you were really good though. And I like that, you know, kids, you know, I did this too, because I played some adults. I drew the listener can't see what I'm doing. I drew the wrinkles, you know, the way the 24-year-old adults have deep, deep wrinkles and brown pencil on their faces, you know, and every other tooth blacked out. You know, the way adults look.
You look like a jack-o'-lantern with a meth addiction. It's so insane.
My temple's grayed.
Yeah, you get a toothbrush with white paint on it, and you start brushing it up in your sideburns. That's right.
It's like you're not fooling anyone, 11-year-old Alex. You know, we know you're 11.
In every community theater production of Annie, the guy who was playing FDR was always the youngest guy in the cast, always. Every production I ever saw of that, I thought that was so funny to me.
Well said.
I'm so well glad said. we just had this gigantic laugh about this. That makes me laugh. Yeah, so hard.
Well, it's pretty funny.
All right, keep going. We were talking about how community theater was a big part of your life. You did Oliver four, almost five times.
Yeah, you know, I also will say Andrew Kober was the baker to my Jack.
God love him. God, I love that. Oh, and I really had no idea that you guys had such a theater upbringing together.
We really did, and we were in the Cleveland Cabaret troupe together.
Oh,
and I think there are probably other shows we were in together, but I don't remember all of them, but those are the two that stand out in my mind that I did with Andrew.
So when did you and Andrew have this horrible falling out?
Well. Nah, I mean, I've always loved Andrew. He's amazing. And
he's hard not to love, absolutely.
Right? And he was one of like the cool older kids that I looked up to. And I have memories of going to when the cabaret troupe would go to IHOP at 4 a.m. together, and Andrew would be driving me, and I was like this little ninth grader, and you know,
that's it. That's so cool. Yeah. Yes, that's
and you know some other guys too who I was a part of Cleveland Theater with. Ben Fankhauser is one. Max Chernin is another.
Wow. So,
yeah, we're all from the same general area, and we're all doing.
You and Andrew have done wonders, but those other two, I don't know.
Those other guys, I don't know.
Nothing really. Nothing of note.
Who are they? Yeah, but anyway, the point is, I was doing a lot of stuff and really thrilled about it, and working really hard, and always taking it very, very seriously. And I went to college for acting at Boston University.
Yeah. Oh wow. Okay. I think I knew that, but may have forgotten. Boston University. Excellent.
Uh huh. Yeah, and I went there, and that was a you know, though conservatory is full of abusive teachers, as so many people can attest to. At the same time, there were really good things. Like I did a lot of writing in college, which I was doing anyway as a kid, but I started doing it really seriously when I got to college, and I was like, oh, this is a thing for me. This is something I love. This is another way to express that very same impulse that makes me want to act.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Can we just talk about you as a writer real quick? Because your brain, sure. I mean, like, people are probably listening at this point and they can hear that you're a writer just based on how fast you can take an idea and jump off of it. You're a great improviser in that way. But I think that that is part of the writer's brain and just the way you told that story about that woman saying, I'm so tired. That kills me. When did you, because I remember sitting down with you, maybe we were at Westway Diner, is that what it's called, on 9th Ave? I think.
Yeah.
And you were telling me about something you were writing and you were filming, and I was like so excited for you, but I was also kind of thinking like, why haven't you been doing that? But you have been writing for like
a long time. A long time, and I didn't put a lot of things out there. It's a later in life. It's a real, sun. It's, and now that I'm in my sunset years, I feel a little more ready to put myself out there as a writer. I did a lot in college. I was just writing songs.
Well, you are a great songwriter, and I don't think anybody knows that about you. I mean, people, it's not widely known that you're an amazing songwriter and musical theater writer. You really, really are. I've heard lots of your stuff, and it's fucking tremendous.
Thank you. I had a musical when I first got to New York. One of the very first things I did, I got some acting jobs and things were going nicely. And then I also got a musical that I wrote in the New York Musical Theater Festival.
Yes.
It was a wonderful experience where I lost $30,000 and got panned in the New York Times.
I was waiting for it.
Yeah. It was
experience. That's precisely it. Lose money in record time and then have somebody much older than you not understand your art. That is
exactly him. Yeah. And that was my dream, really, is to have someone older than me tell me that I was garbage. And don't worry, it's happened so many times. My dream just keeps coming true. So but I had this like really horrifying experience in NIMH where the show that ended up going up was not what it was not what was in my head. It totally got away from me. And I did not have the experience or the maturity to deal with that financially, emotionally, artistically, I couldn't be the kind of leader that I can be now to say, no, my idea is this, and this is what should happen. Instead, I was just like, okay, I'll do whatever you want. I'll do whatever you want. And it just became something else.
I've been there many times myself. I totally understand that. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's really hard when you're young and you're trying so hard to make sure everybody likes the thing that you're writing. And then and it turns out that nobody likes it because it isn't yours anymore. It's so far away from
your
vision.
And you're listening to people like they have one more credit on their resume. So you go, well, they must know one more thing than I do. I'm going to listen to them. And then it's not necessarily in the right hands. Been down
totally.
That path several times.
You end up just throwing the baby out with the bathwater, I guess.
100%.
So I had this experience and then I was very, to be honest, quite traumatized from it. So much so that I didn't put anything else out there as a writer for about 7 years.
Yeah. This was the moment I was like, where has it been? Yeah.
Yeah. And I was writing privately. I was, I took that show that was a Nymph and I rewrote it about 4 or 5 times and did some private readings to try to make it better. And I definitely took some big steps with it, though it still has, those, how do you say it? Those vestiges of the, old idea that doesn't quite fully work. And so eventually I started some other things that didn't quite see the light of day. It wasn't until I started working with Wes Taylor that he finally gave me the confidence to put my stuff out there. And because I was working with him and because it was a team effort and it wasn't all riding or dying on my shoulders, succeeding or dying on my show, it was a shared thing. I felt like I could summon the bravery, and Wes helped me do it, to put myself out there. So we started this show, Indoor Boys, which now we've done 3 seasons. And that's
my mom adorably continues to call it the Inside Boys. So I often go,
where's the lie?
I correct her every time, but I think it's adorable. You know when moms are like, oh, I love Britney Aguilera. They're like so close, but it's not the right thing.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFF's creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFF's The Original New Musical from Shayna Taub is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Don't you just love Alex Wise? Well, let me tell you how you can love him even more by following him and supporting him. Go find Alex Wise on Instagram and Twitter and keep up with what he has going on. He is one of my favorite artistic humans. Please keep up with everything he does. And let me just say this about his Twitter account. He is so magnificently funny that it makes up for all the mountain of garbage that Twitter usually has. So go check it out for yourself. Also go see for yourself his amazing performance and writing on the Indoor Boys. Seasons 1 through 3 are available at indoorboys.tv. You don't want to miss it. Now, more with Alex Wise.
Can I ask about Wes Taylor? How did that come about? What were you guys working on that led to Indoor Boys? And like, I'm sure you guys were friends through the business. And
yeah, I knew him just socially a little bit. We had hung out once or twice over, some time in the past decade. But then I moved to Los Angeles because I got cast in a very creative role on The Bold and the Beautiful, in which I got to flex all my creativity, said with deep sarcasm. But no, it was a really cool job, and I got to be a part of a really interesting world. That part is true.
Yeah.
And work with some nice people. And so I was there doing in LA doing Bold and Beautiful, and Wes was there. He was doing some various television jobs and had moved out there for other reasons. Yeah. And so I think maybe it was on Instagram. I saw that he was, and when you're a New Yorker kind of plopped in LA, you search for your like-minded people. So I think we texted like, oh, you're here. I'm here. We should meet up. We should hang
absolutely.
Out.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we did. And after we hung out a couple of times, it was Wes who said to me, we should really write something together. To which I said, no. No.
Why turn it down? So first of all, how often does that question come up when you like click with someone and you're like, wow, we have a funny rapport. This could be a fun collaborative effort here. And then it just never sees the light of day. The idea never gets past the computer screen, or the meeting to write something in the first place never happens. It's a lot of talk. So you guys are already defying odds by sitting down and going, let's actually do this and write something. I think that in itself is fucking amazing.
I agree, because I had felt before in my before times that there's like, you know, post Wes and pre Wes, but like PW. Wes really, in P, oh no, they're both P,
pre W.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah. But before I think I'd let a lot of moments pass me by, or I had, worked on them privately, but then said, no one ever needs to see this. By the same token, though, I might not have been ready to. Oh, look at, listen to that. You hear that? It was my doorbell, and I'm not going to answer it.
You're allowed. We can take a minute for you to answer the door. Is it Amazon? Is it something that needs to come in?
I'm not expecting anything other than disturbances. It's fine. But I forget what I was saying, other than
you and Wes, and how he got you going.
Yeah, we gave it a shot. I remember we made the first episode of Indoor Boys. It wasn't even called Indoor Boys yet.
That's when it was called Inside Boys.
That was Inside Boys, you know, back when, it was your mom's idea we were trying to bring to light.
Yeah, she pitched it.
Yeah, and it really just became Indoor Boys by circumstance, because we were like, well, we have one location. What if we never leave? That's pretty much what happened.
I mean, but like how the way you're talking about this so casually, and then you can look at the list of awards you've been nominated for and won, including Emmy Awards. Is it like, did you ever see this happening? Like something that starts as casually as this might have. I never in my wildest dreams would I see a collaboration with one of my friends going this way and going this well and being this well received. You have an army of people that clung onto this, man. It's so fucking rad to see.
Thanks. I mean, really the best part of it is, I this might sound like BS, but the part of being a writer that I really like is the not selfish part. Like the part that I love is the part where you get to be a proud parent. I love the part where where other people get to feel creative because I built a stage that they get to step onto. That's the part that thrills me. And the idea that because I'm writing this, this means we get to work with this person. If I write for this person, we can bring them on board and then we can all have an experience together. That's the part that really excites me and makes me want to write new things and helps me create new characters, as I think about, well, who do I want to work with? Okay, what if I write a role for instance, in Indoor Boys? What if we write stuff for Carolee Carmello and V.N. Cox? Two actresses I'm obsessed with who are incredible. And we reached out and said, you want to do this? Because we want you to do this. And we wrote roles for the two of them.
It's like everything you say is not surprising, but the most amazing. I just see this as something that you were born to do. Listen to the story you just told and the people you were raised from. And like, I know it's kind of weird, but the fact that you have an advertising bloodline basically on your dad's side, I'm sure that is part of where the apple falls in terms of your writing brain. Do you think that's what it is?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I feel very inspired by I still think about a lot of things that my grandma used to say to me about writing. She always used to say, writing is rewriting. Writing is just rewriting, which, you know, is a common thing to be said, but the first time I heard it was from my grandma, and I really think about that a lot. And that gives me the bravery to write a really crappy first draft. And then it's about the work ethic that you have and the passion that you have to adjust and adjust and adjust and trim and cut and add a word and rearrange. And that's what turns it into something inspired. But all you have to do is just, the way I think about writing is I'm just going to close my eyes, open up a blank document and write something that is terrible. This is the worst thing ever. And I'm just going to get from the top of the page to the bottom and make the worst thing ever. But then there's some kind of spark in here. There's some little thing in here that I have to save. There's that one line that's so beautiful that I need to make the other lines around it match what's happening there or justify the presence of that line. Do you know what I mean?
Like, I 100% that's... know what you mean. Yes. I think you and I have a very similar approach and basically a mission statement when it comes to being a writer and the stresses that come with it. But some of those stresses are a lot of the most beautiful aspects of being a writer because of what the outcome is. When you're throwing spaghetti at the wall and once it starts crusting and peeling off the wall and you see what's left and it spells out, you're a genius, Drew. You're like, I did it somehow. I don't know how, but I fucking did it. And you, the way you talk about writing, you remind me a lot of somebody you and I both know quite well. Alex Brightman has the same exact,
he's brilliant
step forward when it comes to how he writes. And he and I definitely collaborate on a number of things, but when he's off doing his thing, boy, I'd love to be a fly on the wall of that solo adventure because, well, maybe not all of it, but some of it for reasons I won't discuss here. But I think you guys have the same exact approach of I'm going to allow myself to write something awful and then see the beauty in there so that I can refine and refine and refine until this, you know, chunk of coal becomes a diamond or whatever some cliche is, insert cliche here. I think it's fucking wonderful. A lot of people, like we just talked about Indoor Boys for a minute, and I want to go back to what you've done on Broadway, because what you've done on Broadway, this again is like this Ron Howard idea, is you can be this writer, creator, actor on screen. And then you see you on Broadway and you are the funniest, most heartfelt, most endearing human being when it comes to like the human experience and seeing it live. I saw you a long time ago. This is around the time we were getting real chummy, I think, was when you were doing Triassic Park. And nobody remembers that goddamn show. And it is to this day one of the greatest theatrical experiences. If you're listening now, if you've made it this far in the interview, for the love of God, go check out the Triassic Park soundtrack. I believe it still exists somewhere out in the ether.
I think it's on Spotify and iTunes and stuff.
It is. So tell me how proud you are of that, because I loved watching that.
That was one of the best experiences I've ever had as an actor, ever.
Man.
It was remarkable. So for anyone who doesn't know, Triassic Park was essentially Jurassic Park from the perspective of the dinosaurs.
Yes.
So we all played. So I played a velociraptor and in the canon of Jurassic Park, all the dinosaurs are bred to be female. So we were all female dinosaurs. And it was a beautiful, creative, silly experience.
So funny.
Yeah, and the writer and director, Marshall Paylette, who is still someone I'm working with and still someone I'm close
with. Very smart guy, yeah.
Very smart. He really taught me a lot at that time about, you know, it's one thing to like perform the timing of a joke, but it's another thing to really build the truth of the moment beneath that timing. And I think those two things together that Marshall so beautifully helped us create in the rehearsal room made for this like thrilling experience on stage where I was so engaged in my body and my voice, but we were doing something so dumb. It was so dumb, but it was so full-hearted.
Yeah. No, nobody was giving it a half performance at any point. People knew how dumb it was just by the concept in itself. But boy, when you see that shit live, the audience is right there with you, not with just the dumbness of it all, but the hilarity and the heart of it all. I'm telling you, you guys gave earnest performances as these dinosaurs. How fucking insane is that to say out loud?
Right. We were really feeling it. as I was searching for like, oh gosh, I sort of forget now. As I was searching for like, you know, what's the true story of who are my parents?
Yeah. And
yeah, that's amazing. That's what a lot of the journey
loved it.
Was.
You know, I took my brother there to see it. He was visiting New York as part of his bachelor party.
No way.
Yeah. Who does that? Who says, let's see a musical for your bachelor party? But that one, it made sense. It wasn't like audience interactive and like something Vegas-y and dumb. It was like a real musical you sit and you listen to. I thought right. It was a joy. It was a lot of fun. But theater-wise, you do Lysistrata Jones. Did mm-hmm. you think that was going to be the big one?
It was certainly the biggest one at that moment because...
At that one. Yeah,
I don't think I could even stop and think about like, will this be a success? Will it not be? Because it was like getting shot out of a cannon.
Yeah. The way that went from off Broadway to Broadway was like a big, like, holy shit, look at this thing go.
Yeah. And it was really fast. And it was my off Broadway debut. And mm-hmm. then I spin around and it's my Broadway debut. And I'm just like, oh my God. Oh my God. This is happening. Yeah. This is happening. And then they're like, you're closed. We hate you. You're closed.
You're paraphrasing, home. Of course. Yeah.
Yes.
You're closed. Go home.
Go home, you idiot. That's what it was a crazy thing to experience. And I learned quite a lot about getting back up after you've been knocked down.
You are a prime example of that because you've had, not to say you've been knocked down so many times, it's astounding.
I feel I have.
But I mean, like that's part of the occupational hazard of getting into show business is you get dinged up. You think you're doing something amazing and then no one agrees with you that it's amazing. And you can't say, but look at the work. You can't do that. You can't try to convince everybody else. So you do get dinged up. But something that you were a part of on stage, and I know I'm just kind of resume hopping right now, and I'm just touching on these things because people can Google you, for Christ's sake. And sure. I'm more interested in your upbringing and the woman saying, I'm so tired and things, and your grandmother, Lois, and all that kind of stuff. But you did the revival, and I want to talk about this a little bit. The revival of Spring Awakening, which I thought was so interesting because you and I are virtually the same age, I believe.
And
that show was on Broadway, the original cast, when we were of the age to be in the original cast.
Yeah, that's true.
And then it's revived. Everyone's like, this is coming back to Broadway. I thought it was just here a minute ago. It's this brand new look at it because Michael is amazing. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh my God, and Alex Weiss and Andy Mientis is in this? And you guys look fucking younger than you did when you were in your goddamn 20s. I don't understand you.
Listen, foundation can go a long way.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Come on. Those stage lights and those balcony seats, they're forgiving.
I couldn't believe it though. I was like amazed at how good you guys fucking age. It's mind blowing. Maybe it's because I age like a rotting squash.
I don't know about that. I think you look like an adult man. And I am.
And that's because I've been bleaching out my teeth and I've been painting the brown on my face.
It's the only way anyone's going to know you're an adult.
Exactly. I'm an adult man. They can tell by the lines.
Right. Anyway, to steal from, you know, the great John Mulaney, I just look like an elderly child. you know, it's like, are you okay, old child? that's a great Mulaney joke, but I feel similarly. You know, that Spring Awakening experience for me is another example of sort of being... my experience leading up to Spring Awakening, I left New York because I had my Lysistrata Jones experience. I toured with Wicked. I did other things. And
yes.
I felt like upon coming back to New York, especially after Wicked, I felt like I can't get a break. No one will see me for things. I just feel like I can't do anything. And at that point, LA started... very unexpectedly opening its doors to me. Mm-hmm. It just was just kind of like an accident that I ended up starting. I started to get TV shows. And so I was like, okay, I guess I'll never be on Broadway again. So I'm just going to go to LA. And I thought, that's the only way. I have to do something. And I really needed to sort of reinvent myself because I felt very stuck, and I felt like, it felt like people had made up their minds about me and what I can do and what I can't do in terms of New York. And I couldn't get people to see past their perception, their decided perception. So I went to LA and I was following this path of getting some TV work, which was really cool and unexpected. And then Spring Awakening happened. And it happened, I mean, I got cast in that show because I was friends with Andy and Michael, and they sent me a text message and they said, "Wanna be in Spring Awakening?" And I was like, well, okay. I was like, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll see if I'm free that week.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there's nothing on my radar that was like, this is going to be the next moment. It was just like, oh, okay, I guess you're doing a thing. Sure.
But what a moment it turned into. I mean,
it was a life changer.
Spring Awakening fans are rabid in the first place, but this particular Deaf West production was like, was the stage door absolutely fucking crazy for you guys?
Yeah, it was. It was.
Yeah, I love that.
It was amazing, and you know, sometimes challenging in that way. But the real point of the story for me is how I don't know, just how unexpected it was, and that by giving up on the dream of Broadway, I found my way back there.
Yeah.
I was just, you know what it was? It was, I went to this dance call for a show. That's my first mistake, is I went to a dance call for a show, and I did so badly, and I was so mortified dancing in front of, you know, the whole cast of Newsies that I went home, and that day I booked a plane ticket to LA, and I was like, I'm gone. I can't do it anymore. I'm gone. I'm not coming back. And then a series of things happened that brought me back to New York in a very unexpected way. So
you hear that, kids? If you give up on your dreams, they might come true.
You have to give up. Yeah.
You have to give up.
You got to give up. Kids, you got to give up.
The sincerity in your voice. You have to give up.
You have to give up.
It's
only white kids. I really think, though, that the stuff that I have planned for the stuff that I had planned for my life, I thought, well, by this age, I'll do this, or I will be in this show, or whatever it is. This is the year I get my series regular. It never happens that way.
Never.
But the thing that does happen is usually the thing, I mean, it's not always across the board, and this might be a little like spiritual BS stuff, but
no, let's hear it. I love spiritual BS.
But it does seem like the stuff that happens is more the stuff we need and the stuff that we, versus the stuff we want.
Yeah.
You know, what I wanted more than anything was to be in the ensemble of Tuck Everlasting. And I just couldn't dance it. I just couldn't dance it.
How dare you?
That's what I wanted. I was so damn sure.
The ensemble of Tuck Everlasting.
That's what I wanted. And it's, I mean, no disrespect to any of the people who did that. And
no, I love the score. It's great. It's great.
Yeah, but that's like that audition was mortifying, and it set me over the edge. Mortifying.
Oh my God.
And I just failed so hard. But then I ended up getting more of what I needed, which was a really transformative theater experience and being introduced to many of my people who are still some of my closest friends today by doing Spring Awakening. That's what I needed.
Absolutely. That's a great jumping off point, actually. I have a segment I like to do from time to time called Very Dumb Questions with Drew.
Good.
And this is not so dumb of a question. It's actually a great question. Catherine Gallagher was on this podcast on your birthday, actually. And we both said happy birthday, Alex, when she was here. I want to play a game where I ask just random questions. The first one being, can you please name three of your favorite things about Catherine Gallagher?
Yes.
Great.
I'll start with a yes.
Great.
Okay. Three of my favorite things
about Catherine Gallagher. Yes.
She is so creative in terms of, just always, you know, everything she feels goes into a song with such ease.
Yes.
Yeah. Her creativity feels very easy.
Yes.
Like she sits back with it almost.
Yeah. How dare her? While I'm ripping my hair out, she lays back and another great song comes out. It's just, it's unfair for me to see that. I got like three strands left up here.
You look great. I mean, the bone structure doesn't lie.
Oh my God.
It's true. Okay. More about Catherine.
Two more things.
I love that she is, and I don't mean like, intelligence, because I think she's smart, but she's like a moron, you know, in the best way. Like she just laughs like a buffoon, and she acts like a fool, the most delightful fool that I can think of.
I love it. She's a delightful fool. That's a perfect number two. Give me that third one, baby.
She's incapable of sending a text without egregious spelling errors.
Oh boy. I don't know why that's so endearing to me. I have this. Yeah,
but what it is, it's like a series of like letters and numbers and exclamation points, and it's up to you to decipher it. But it's just like she takes a handful of letters and throws them at a screen. And
it's a violent Scrabble game, just an angry game of Scrabble. Or she's typing in Wingdings, and maybe it's like hieroglyphics and shit like that.
She's often typing in Wingdings. Yeah.
She's often typing in Wingdings. God, that should be a text feature if that's not already one. Please do.
I'd like to add that the internet thinks that Catherine and I are in a committed relationship.
And we're going to continue that rumor here today. Good. So you guys are about to have a baby together.
Yeah, no, we are naming her Eddie.
Wow. Know? No, very, very woke of you. And how far along are you?
About 13 months.
13 months. Okay, so any minute now. I ask questions about Catherine Gallagher because I've made it no secret here that I have a relentless crush on her that I am just, I'm very out loud about. I tell it right to her face. I can't even help it. I think she is the coolest person for whatever reason. I think she is the coolest person. I have a couple more random questions for you before I say thank you for your time and kick you off this this podcast.
Sure.
What is something you will never do? Mine is get a belly button ring. What's yours?
I'll never get on a boat. I have a very strict no boat rule for my life.
I like that. I can't handle the idea that people think cruises are fun because you're just trapped in the middle of the fucking sea.
That's correct. And with the worst kind of person. When I was a kid, my family went on four holiday seasons in a row, we went on four cruises. The end of that tumultuous period of my life, in which I would sit in the cabin and just read novels waiting for the cruise to be over, my whole family really made a decision that we would never get on a cruise again. And I, to this day, maintain that I will not step on a boat because every time someone runs into an ex on a TV show, they're on a boat and you can't get off the boat.
You're just stuck with them. And that is, that's no fun. That's no fun.
No boats. No boats.
No boats. Okay. That's good. That's something he won't do. Two more questions for you. Alex, do you think R.L. Stine enjoys scaring children? Or do you think he likes writing scary stories? There is a difference. What do you think his goal is here?
I imagine R.L. Stine desperately doesn't want to scare children, but as he writes, he cries and whispers to himself, "I have to tell this story."
He can't help it.
He's so upset that he has to tell you. He so desperately wants to spread cheer, but his pen bleeds. God. His pen just bleeds.
I love that so much. That is 10,000 times better than any answer I could have anticipated. I love that. Did you know that his son was the sound guy for Beetlejuice?
No way, really?
Yeah. I think that's so random and somewhat so fitting. Cool. Last question for you. Alex Wise, this is called this game is called Who Would Make a Better Grilled Cheese Pop Star Edition.
Okay.
Who do you think would make a better grilled cheese sandwich out of these three pop stars? Dua Lipa, Taylor Swift, or Harry Styles?
That's really hard.
I know.
This is probably the hardest question, and I really have to dig deep into my psyche and my traumas to uncover to uncover the truth of this.
Dig into your traumas.
Yeah, let me just dig into my traumas. I'm gonna go with Harry Styles because I feel like he would buy like a really fancy cheese to make it into the most like, you know, what am I trying to say? That his grilled cheese is a little different, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. He'd probably do something really artisanal, a little fig jam or something. Yeah, you know what I mean?
I can see with fig jam, yeah.
Yeah, I can see something going on. I don't know that Dua Lipa has ever had a grilled cheese. I'm still...
Yeah, I don't know enough about Dua Lipa. And I feel like Taylor Swift, hers would be like reliable, American cheese, it'd be fine.
Yep,
100%. But I just see Harry Styles with the fig. Can I ask you a question? Is this really the best note to end on? I feel like... Yeah,
this is it. And that's it, everybody. Thank you so much.
Oh, my God.
Here's the note we will end on. Thank you, first of all, for playing These Are Dumb Questions with Drew. I don't know what the name of the segment is. But I do want to say, because we've been going almost an hour here, I don't want to take up more of your time today, Alex. I thank you for giving me so much of your time today. But I want to stand by my claim here that you are basically this Ron Howard-esque, uber-likable, overly talented, non-stop, committed to the work, committed to the process kind of guy. And those are my favorite kinds of guys in this industry. And Lord knows there's not enough of them. I really have always loved our time together and when you and I get to hang out, whether it's collaborative or it's just chatting like this or bumping into you somewhere. I just think you're the loveliest guy in the entire world. And I think that Lois Wise, who had such an impact on you, would be rather proud of what she didn't get to see you do after college, because it is bewildering and like I said, not surprising at all, but always amazing. And I love you very much, my friend.
Wow. Thanks. Thank you, Drew. I love you too. And thanks for having me on here. This is really fun.
I really did have a great time talking with Alex Wise. Hey, welcome to the outro, the end of the episode. You made it. This is where I give an over-caffeinated thank you. Thanks to all you guys for listening. I'm going to say that one more time, I'm sure, before this outro is done. Let me just say that Now We're Talking is a proud member of the Broadway Podcast Network. Have you gotten the app yet? Go get the app. You can find out more about me and this podcast at bpn.fm/Now We're Talking. I'm on Instagram and Twitter and TikTok at Drew Gasparini, so check me out there and stay tuned for what else I got going on. A special thanks to my man, Alex Wise. I've known him for years, and it just is one of the greatest things to watch him flourish. I loved chatting with you, my man. Come back anytime. And thank you, all you listeners, for being super sexy and tuning in. Hey, make sure to subscribe and rate this podcast wherever you stream your podcast. And keep tuning in. We'll see you next week.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.